On what basis did she determine that when originally she had the factual basis to report he was born in Kenya? She declined to explain what documentation or evidence provided the reason for the change. Other organizations have made similar changes. United Press International and Snopes.com both at one time had statements that President Obama was born at Queens Medical Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. But they later changed the reference to the Kapiolani Medical Center for Women and Children in Honolulu. NPR's promotion for the story had included a brief description of West African correspondent Keist Arctun, who, quote, describes the stories that have been exciting, including the U.S. presidential race of Kenyan-born Senator Barack Obama, unquote. Keist Arctun described Obama as a member of the Kenyan Luo tribe and reported how Africans viewed the race. You know, the campaign has absolutely fired the imagination, not only of American people, but of Africa, she said. For a start, Barack Obama's father is from Kenya. The opposition leader, Raila Odinga, comes from the same tribe as Barack Obama's father, the Luo. The joke was going around Kenya that America is going to have a Luo president before Kenya does. Barack Obama's grandmother indicated that she saw him born in Kenya, was present at his birth in Kenya. A retired major general who is decorated combat veteran and ran an abbreviated campaign for the presidency in 2008 says Congress should deliver an ultimatum to President Obama: prove your eligibility or quit. The comments came from Major General Jerry Curry, who served in Vietnam and commanded the U.S. Army Test and Evaluation Command at Aberdeen Proving Ground during his long military career. We don't want to get into political arguments here, political issues. But quite frankly, if this man is an imposter, if he indeed is a usurper, as a nation, as a people, we are in deep, deep trouble. Our exposure just on the issue of national security is vast. How can God bless a nation and protect a people who close their eyes, cover their faces, and pretend like two-year-olds? They cannot and will not see the truth and won't even explore it, won't even compel this man by popular effort, force him to reveal the truth. I'm not talking about military force. I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about the people rising up and demanding the truth. We demand all kinds of other things. It would seem that this would be the most fundamental thing. The Congress. There would be enough congressmen who would have enough guts to demand the truth and take steps to implement it. Now, if he indeed is eligible, fine. You don't have to like him. You don't have to like his politics, but at least he's there legitimately. But if he's there as a usurper, illegitimately, it violates the most fundamental protection of the Constitution, and that is not the Bill of Rights, but that the Commander-in-Chief, the one who is leading the nation, have only one allegiance after God himself, and that is to we the people and the country. This is a matter for prayer, my friends. It's very serious. Thanks for joining us here on Viewpoint Today. Jesus warned about the deception that would ravage the earth. And friends, not all deception is deception against the Word of God. It's about life itself. Get a copy of my book, Seduction of the Saints, Staying Pure in a World of Deception. Your gift of $18 or more to Save America Ministries. Make sure you get your Jewish calendars. They're going very, very rapidly. $13 or more to Save America Ministries. Call us 1-800-SAVE-USA. 1-800-SAVE-USA. God bless you, and be in prayer this weekend for our country.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Jeff Kirschmeyer. Viewpoint.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Jerome Corsi, who's a graduate of Harvard. He has his PhD from Harvard. But he now is certainly the senior writer for the WorldNet Daily, and we read his articles are certainly a number every week, and he covers many, many subjects. And what are we going to be talking about tonight, Jerry?
Well, that's Dan. How are you? Good to talk to you. Should we talk about some economics tonight?
All right. I think that's a very important subject. Maybe you could explain to me. President Obama says, you know, I think there's 67,000 new jobs, people going back to work, and yet the unemployment rate is rising. The unemployment rate went from 9.5 to 9.6. I don't know how we could have all those new people getting jobs and the unemployment goes up, but I guess I'm just not smart enough to understand these statistics.
Well, the statistics are largely manipulated by the Department of Labor, and the games they play are many. But what what's happening is that more people are entering the job market, going back and looking for work. And the truth is, if we were going to reduce unemployment right now, we'd have to be creating about 150,000 to 200,000 jobs every month. And creating 67,000 jobs a month doesn't keep up with the number of people who are either recently becoming unemployed or are unemployed and decide that they're going to go back and look for work. So it's just not enough jobs being created to handle the demand for jobs, and the numbers of unemployment went up. It went up to 9.6% in August. So it's clear that we're not keeping up with the people entering the job market.
Well, you know, it was very interesting that the Obama administration controls General Motors. You know, they have a czar there that really directs what's going on. And so General Motors has opened up a production line there in Detroit to produce the Volt cars, a $41,000 hybrid car. And they lose money on every car they produce. It's $41,000, but they still lose money on every car they produce. And my impression is the Obama administration opened to that production line so they could say, look at all these new people going back to work. Why, things are getting a lot better just before the election. Do you think that might have had some reason why they would open a production line to build a car that they lose money on every one they produce?
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, the entire GM is now, it's also increasingly controlled. I mean, the whole bankruptcy situation, now GM's union, United Auto Workers, owns a great deal of GM. So GM is both government and union owned. Now, the Volt that they're producing, it's a car I don't think anybody's going to buy. I mean, first of all, the car is produced at a loss. It costs $41,000 to buy it, even with a $7,500 federal tax credit for the buyers of electric vehicles. I'm not sure this is an attractive vehicle. Every 4 hours, you've got to plug it in. That's as long as the electric battery works. And then it runs on premium gasoline. So we've got to put premium gasoline in the Volt to make it work. So I doubt this is going to be a very attractive car, and if it's not an attractive car, GM's going to be right back into bankruptcy with the inability to market vehicles people will buy.
And, of course, basically, apparently, the batteries go right up the middle of the car, so you're going to get two people in the back seat, two people in the front seat. It's a four-passenger car for $41,000. We'll be back in just a moment here with Jerome Corsi, Dr. Jerome Corsi, talking about the economy. Ladies and gentlemen, America's in real trouble, and I feel that we're not getting better, as President Obama says. Well, please go right ahead.
Well, actually, I've been writing a lot about the there's a big move being made now by the Obama administration to get private retirement assets, 401ks and IRAs, to invest in treasury debt. And when you look at the deficits that we're running $1.4, $1.5 trillion deficits with the Obama administration. Well, somebody's got to buy the treasury debt, and cheaply, because otherwise the cost of borrowing will just be, that's another factor that increasingly will put us bankrupt. But at any rate, looking at how much money there is in retirement plans, there's close to $14 trillion in private retirement assets. So the government says, well, if we can just get some of the IRA and 401k money to go into treasury debt, it'll be a cheap way of financing these budget deficits. So the Department of Labor is going to hold hearings with Treasury on September 14th and September 15th. And I link in my articles to the notices from the Department of Labor about these hearings. And they're to create a government lifetime annuity option in your 401k or your IRA. Now, what that translates to is the government saying, look, we'll put a government annuity in your IRA or your 401k, and it will invest in treasury debt so that, of course, you know, we want to nanny government wants to make sure that you don't lose money when the stock market goes down in your IRA or 401k. So this government annuity with treasury debt will give you a lifetime payout guaranteed by the U.S. government, even if your other investments in the 401k or IRA go bad. Now, that sounds, you know, great, government's here to protect you, until you realize that governments like Argentina confiscated private retirement savings and put in government bonds into those savings. When people came to cash in the bonds, they were worthless. And so you've got with treasury debt, again, the same kind of problem, is it all sounds good, but when it comes time to cash in the treasury debt, get your lifetime income, is that treasury debt going to be worth anything? And, you know, it's the same thing we're doing with Social Security. Social Security right now, the Social Security Administration Trust Fund is filled with, guess what, treasury debt, because Congress has borrowed the money out of the trust fund to pay for other programs that Congress can't afford.
Well, you know, it's really an amazing thing. We've been able to finance our wars all the way from the Vietnam War forward simply on borrowed money. We didn't have to tax the people, and nobody complained. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Corsi is talking about the fact that the Obama administration really wants to get their hands on the 401ks and IRAs, the retirement funds that have been set aside. And of course, actually, the government has a claim on this money. After all, it was put in, and you didn't have to pay income tax with it. And so why shouldn't the government simply be able to take your money? And then, of course, they will give you a guaranteed annuity for life. Only trouble is that when that annuity comes due, will the money be worth anything? Certainly, I think that the way things are going, we could see runaway inflation, or at least the devaluation of the dollars, because certainly we've got so many dollars printed out there, there's nothing behind them. I mean, this is my concern. What are your concerns about this, Jerry?
Well, again, with so much money being, so many bonds being created by the Treasury, we're really monetizing the nation's debt. In other words, we're printing money in order to pay off debt. That every time Social Security, for instance, with all of its Treasury bonds and Social Security Trust Administration, whenever Social Security wants to cash in one of those bonds, which they're having to do now because Social Security's in the red, it's paying out more money than it's taking in. Well, the government, the Treasury, has to issue more debt to pay off the existing debt. So we're monetizing our debt. A sovereign guarantee, you know, this government annuity, the Treasury is thinking about issuing a new series of bonds, these retirement bonds or R bonds. Well, that's fine, but if you need to sell in a secondary market, you know, you need to liquidate your 401k or your IRA for whatever emergency reason, that Treasury bond has a secondary risk. It might not be able to be sold for what you paid for it. And then finally, when you do get paid on it, it may end up being not nearly the dollars you get paid into it worth the dollars that you bought it with because of the debasement of the currency. This is what happened in Argentina. In Argentina, the government just confiscated retirement plans, put in Argentinian bonds, and when people came to cash those bonds in for the retirement, they weren't worth anything.
Well, of course, the bonds that will be issued by the Treasury Department will be backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. The problem is, what is this credit of the United States? Certainly, basically, the Chinese have started to cut back buying American bonds, buying Treasury bonds and agency bonds, because they don't really have much confidence that in the American dollar. They think it's going to fall in value, and they may very well invest and not get their money back. So if the Chinese are really pretty smart, don't put any faith in the credit of the United States, do you think that the average American, who's certainly been saving all of his life for retirement, would he want to put the faith in the credit of the United States when we're having to borrow $4 to $5 billion every day just to pay our bills?
Well, that's the problem, Dr. Tan, is that if the credit rating of the United States gets downgraded, it's going to cost more interest just to pay the debt, to raise new debt, to pay the interest on the existing debt. And there's two things I want to explain. John Kerry just introduced what they're calling automatic IRAs. It's a bill he's introduced with Jeff Bingaman. It's Senate 3760. And it's calling for all corporations, whether or not if you don't have an existing retirement plan, you'll be forced to take 3% of the employee's pay and put it into an automatic IRA, whether you want to do so or not. The employees would have to opt out. And there'll be like three investment options in this automatic IRA. One of them will be the Treasury retirement bond, or the R bond, which would be structured as, of course, the principal preservation fund, because it's, again, government-guaranteed bonds. But there's, several. This again is a method of the government saying, well, we're going to make sure everybody has IRAs. Everything's like forced savings, government intruding in the workplace. But again, the agenda is to find a way to get the foot in the door and start getting IRA or 401k assets into Treasury debt. And that's, the agenda, the underlying agenda of these automatic IRAs is to get a third of the money into Treasury retirement bonds, and then to expand from there into other IRAs or 401ks to do the same. With, 14, as I say, $14 or $15 trillion in retirement assets, private retirement assets in the United States and retirement plans, government with running this much debt, the Obama administration is determined to get some of that retirement assets into Treasury debt, and pretty soon, 401ks and IRAs are going to start looking just like Social Security.
And, Chris, that is the fear. Social Security was a Ponzi scheme. The Ponzi scheme has run out. They're actually having to put out more money than's coming in, and we're just on the verge of a retirement of massive numbers of baby boomers, something like, 70 to 75 million are going to retire in the next 20 years, on top of the 54 million already retired. And even with the 54 million or so retired, why we can't really afford to pay them their money. We're putting out more money than's coming in. So they've got to come up with money from someplace, either that or begin raising the age of retirement or raising the amount that people put into the Social Security and Medicare. The problem is if you raise these rates too high, why, of course, employers aren't going to be able to hire people here in the United States. They simply got to pick up and move overseas. And certainly when a small company suddenly has to put an additional 3%, they already have to put their, 15% in for Social Security and Medicare, and then they want another 3% on top of that for retirement programs. I mean, pretty soon small businesses are either not going to open or they're just going to close down.
Well, the entire Ponzi scheme behind Social Security, and again, when you take a look at the IRAs, and the 401K is going in the same direction, right now the Social Security Administration Trust Fund is filled with treasury bonds, and in fact, I read about this and say the only way to cash in these treasury bonds is to create new treasury debt. So when you find there's a three-ring binder in a white metal cabinet in Parkersburg, West Virginia, the offices of the Bureau of Public Debt, which is a division of the Treasury Department. This was in this office in Parkersburg was opened in the 1950s. It was part of a plan to locate government functions outside of Washington in case of a Cold War nuclear attack. And by the way, it's in that three-ring binder. If you want to find out your Social Security Administration trust fund, what treasury bonds and bills are in the trust fund, you've got to go take a look at that three-ring binder in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Well, basically what you're saying is that the trust fund for Social Security is simply debt. In other words, it's simply bonds, that are redeemable by the Treasury, but the Treasury doesn't have any money.
That's right.
It's having to go out and borrow the money to pay off the bonds.
That's right. It's a total Ponzi scheme. Not only the fact there's so many baby boomers retiring and there's fewer Americans working to pay. I mean, when you get a Social Security check, that's not your money being returned. Somebody else is working and paying in Social Security taxes, and you're getting their money. And by the time the baby boomers are finished retiring, there's only going to be, there's far fewer people working to pay their retirement. And the whole thing collapses. It collapses also by 2037. The Social Security Trust Fund is absolutely bankrupt, totally exhausted, 2037. And the idea that Social Security this year is going to pay out $29 billion more than it's taken in. The fact is half of the baby boomers are starting to take out a percentage of the Social Security benefits as early as age 62 because they're short of cash and they can't find jobs. So the entire system of Social Security has collapsed, and now with the Obama administration in such dire straits with needing again to raise $1.5 trillion in debt just to keep the federal budget going, they're looking at private retirement accounts, taking the good assets out of private retirement accounts and giving people more treasury IOUs. So again, we'll create the same bankruptcy situation, technical bankruptcy, within private retirement accounts, because your IRA or 401k, if this plan succeeds, is going to be increasingly dependent on the government treasuries to be able to pay you.
Well, what happens if the government doesn't have any money? Because government doesn't have any money. This is one of the most carefully kept secrets of in America. Government doesn't have any money. The only money it has is what it can take from us by force and fear through taxation, or certainly what it can borrow from other countries or from the American people, or what it can actually print. And, of course, when they print, they destroy the value of the dollars that are already in existence. So, really, the idea that we can depend upon the government to pay us back when they don't have any money, my understanding is that certainly right now there are about three workers working for every person retired. 20 years from now, there'll be one person working for every person retired. And why would people want to work, when somebody's retired and they're putting in maybe 20 or 30 or 40% of their income to pay and keep this other person retired, even though he may well be comfortably off. He could afford to retire on his own, but he's been guaranteed that he's going to get this money from the government. Free money.
I think people need to appreciate how desperate the situation is now that the Federal Reserve is going to start buying again Treasury debt. We need to talk about that.
Well, I think it's so important because basically they're just creating money out of nothing to buy debt. They call it quantitative easing. They don't tell people what it is. They use these fancy terms. I think assuming people won't understand. Would that be a fair estimate?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi, a senior correspondent for WorldNet Daily. And if you don't read his articles there, well, you're missing a great deal. But Dr. Corsi has the ability to crystallize these ideas into words. It's so important, ladies and gentlemen. You understand that they put Bernie Madoff in prison for running a Ponzi scheme. We reward our congressmen and senators who are doing exactly the same thing, and not one of them will tell you the truth. Well, Jerry, you go right ahead.
Well, so through last year, Federal Reserve was buying Treasury debt. Treasury would issue
gold, and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316corn.com and call 1-877-316-CORN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle corns today by going to john316corn.com and calling 1-877-316-CORN.
Over $200 trillion. I mean, the gross domestic product's only $14 trillion. There's no way it'll ever be paid off. Dr. Corsi is simply saying that he's been putting out an economic newsletter. It's cost $100 a year. Now, suddenly, it's going to become available for nothing. How can people subscribe to the Red Alert?
They can get Red Alert through redalert.wnd.com, World Net Daily. Redalert.wnd.com, simply subscribe. As free. I'm also a managing director at Guilford Securities in New York, G-I-L-F-O-R-D. Guilford Securities has a national client base. It's been in business for 30 years. I'm absolutely convinced, as is Joseph Era at WorldNet Daily, we're going to have, next 2 years are going to be extremely difficult. We want to get as much financial information in the hands of people as we can that can be practically useful to them. So if you go to GuilfordSecurities.com, please, at the top, there's a Financial Services Group tab. Click that, fill out the form. We'll get you enrolled at Guilford Securities, and also make sure you get Red Alert every week free from WorldNet Daily.
Well, of course, the problem is that basically we're looking at the potential collapse of our economy, collapse of our dollar, and certainly, if not collapse, certainly a significant devaluation, so that the people who've worked their whole lives, you know, to accumulate dollars may find those dollars are only worth 50 cents, 30 cents, something of that sort. And that's a frightening thing, but of course, this is what always happens when countries, of course, spend more than they're taking in. You can't spend your way into prosperity. I don't care what Obama says, you know, running a deficit somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion this year. You can't blame that on George Bush. That's Obama's deficits.
Well, and China, let's take a look at China, because China, I think, is a good indication of how the world is reacting to the United States economic crisis. China has been cutting its holdings of long-term treasuries. They reduced them $21 billion in June. The total Chinese holdings of treasury debt is now about $840 billion. It peaked in June 2009 at $950 billion. So China's reduced by $100 billion very quietly over a year the holdings of treasury debt. And China's instead moved into the euro and into gold. Now, that's a very important... I mean, China holds almost $2.3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. That's the largest amount any country has ever held in the history of the world. It was around, just to get a comparison, it was only about $400 billion in 2004. So China's just done a dramatic increase in foreign exchange reserves, largely because of their exports, their management of their yuan, their currency, which they've kept artificially low. And what is China's appetite for U.S. debt is diminishing. China's made it very clear they're just not going to continue buying U.S. treasuries like they have been buying them, which means the United States is going to be increasingly in a more difficult position to keep financing these large and growing federal budget deficits that Barack Obama seems determined to run. Now, Congress needs to take a look, because China, with their foreign exchange reserves, what they're doing is they're building their military. They were angry that we planned to sell $6.4 billion of advanced weapons to Taiwan. China so has begun reducing their holdings of treasury. They're developing an anti-ship ballistic missile. Which is based on a variant of one of their medium-range ballistic missiles that can actually go about 1,500 kilometers, which is enough distance to be able to hit one of the U.S. aircraft carriers in the Western Pacific Ocean. Now, if China can knock out an aircraft carrier with one anti-ship ballistic missile, that's a game-changer to that since the United States Navy can no longer be considered secure, let alone dominant, the waters off China.
And I think that's a frightening thing to contemplate, that the world is changing, ladies and gentlemen, and you're going to have to learn to look after yourself. You're not going to be able to rely upon the federal government for Social Security or for your retirement. People are going to have to, I think, band together. We're going to have to become more centered in our local communities, try to get them to work to provide the things, certainly for the public, and then for the people who can't afford to look after themselves, there's going to have to be help. But people are going to have to work. People are going to, who are able to work should be working. They shouldn't be subsidized as they are today. You get what you subsidize. You subsidize people to work hard, they work hard. You subsidize people not to work, why, you end up where we are today, with more and more people receiving unemployment benefits. This is Dr. Stan, and we've got Frank waiting patiently on the line from Salinas. Frank, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah. I'd like to ask you if the government nationalizes, you know, make you take public debt for what you have.
Now you're talking about nationalizes your retirement program.
Yes. Now, okay. Would that include private and corporation pension funds and all IRAs and CDs?
It could. That's why I think people need to listen to these hearings the Department of Labor is going to hold with Treasury on September 14th and 15th. And if you look at my articles in Red Alert, WorldNet Daily, I give you the links into the Department of Labor notifications. So these are going to be broadcast over the Internet. You can listen to the webcast of September 14th, 15th, upcoming Department of Labor Treasury hearing. There's no doubt in my mind that federal government is looking at retirement plans and thinking that a large number of these assets of all kinds of retirement plans, not just IRAs and 401ks, but all kinds need to go into treasuries, and the move is starting. They'll do it stepwise, try to get a foot in the door, and if they succeed, it will be a growing effort. So that's why I want to alert people to it now so we can catch on to it when it's at the very beginning.
And basically, the government is desperate for money. I mean, having to borrow $1.5 trillion this year, $1.5 trillion. We don't know how much it's going to be, but we'll know by the end of this month. Isn't that when the fiscal year ends?
Fiscal year ends right away, yes. And also, Dr. Stan, the point I'm trying to make, too, is that the Obama administration does not have the same regard for private property as you would expect in a, you know, in a capitalist system or a system that really valued private enterprise. One of the examples of that is both in the GM and the Chrysler bankruptcy. Instead of giving their due in, you know, first order of precedence to the senior secured lenders, the Barack Obama administration came in and told the senior secured lenders they had to give up their position.
And now basically you're talking about the bonds. The bonds ordinarily would be the secure senior positions, and they just said, sorry, we changed the rules.
We changed the rules. And the
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess is Dr. Jerome Corsi from WorldNet Daily, senior writer there. And Corsi also has written a number of books, which many of which we carry here. We have Frank calling from Salinas, who asked, well, you know, if they're talking about certainly taking the money from IRAs and from, you know, from 401ks, what about corporate pension funds? And you know, you actually have worked for somebody for a long period of time, and they have a corporate pension fund. Would that be touched? And Dr. Corsi basically said, we don't know, but we think that they're going to try to get anything that they can. Government is desperate for money. They don't care about certainly these concepts of private property, private accumulation of funds. We saw that, of course, when they nationalized General Motors and Chrysler, and they just told the bondholders, who by law were entitled to certainly share in whatever they could get for selling the factories and the machinery that these companies had. That is always the way it is for bondholders, and the Obama administration just changed the rules, said, sorry, you'll take 20 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar, or you'll get nothing. Which do you want? And, well, some of them got nothing. Frank, do you have anything else to ask before we let you go?
Yes, if you have stocks in your IRA, will they make you sell those stocks and take public debt for the amount that you get for selling the stocks?
Kind of the proposal on the table would be that to start with, some percentage of your IRA or 401k would have to be in this government annuity. So the answer is yes. You'd have to liquidate some to get enough to put into the government debt, the treasury bond, to fund that government annuity. Now the question is going to be, will the Department of Labor and Treasury just put these new rules in going forward for new dollars invested in IRAs or 401ks? Or they do it retroactively and make people readjust their IRAs and 401ks. And that's, again, we're going to have to watch very carefully. I'm going to be reporting on it as they do it. So I've been reporting on this. I've been aware they're going to do this for about a year. And I started writing about this about a year ago. Certainly did a series of articles in January, and now the hearings are going to be held in September. So the Obama administration is gaining speed on this idea, and it's going to have to be watched very carefully.
And, Frank, you have to understand that the way it works is this. You have money, they want it, and they'll use whatever force they have to get it, because these people do not care about the law. They don't care about tradition. It's all about power and money. That is money for them. Hey, thanks so much for calling, and if you just keep listening, why we'll be covering these things
Thank
on a regular basis.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you so much, Frank. And I understand why many, many people are hearing what you're saying, Jerry, and they're very, very concerned, and they should be.
They should be. I'm concerned.
Okay, well, I think we're all concerned, and certainly I'm concerned for so many of our listeners out there who've worked hard all of their lives, and they may be dependent upon their Social Security. They may have their money invested, but certainly if they're in the stock market or in the bond market now, this whole thing could get into real trouble. Bonds are, somebody once said, I think it was Franz Pick, bonds are certificates of guaranteed confiscation, and down the line when they collapse the economy or whatever they're going to do, or simply devalue the dollar, why the people who have their money in bonds will lose a good deal of their investment. And when you get to be older, you're just not in a position to recoup what you've lost. But go right ahead, Dr. Corsi.
Well, I also want to cover the increasing number of Americans that are becoming dependent on government. The Red Alert in this coming week is going to, I have an article, I just wrote it, that one of every six Americans is now receiving government anti-poverty aid of one kind or another. And just listen to the numbers. There's 50 million Americans in Medicaid. There's 40 million Americans getting food stamps. 10 million Americans are receiving unemployment insurance. And 4 million Americans on welfare. Now, when you've got about 12 or 13% of the population that's dependent on government anti-poverty payments, you know, you're really, that's another indication that we've destroyed the middle class. I really think that what I wrote in my book, America for Sale, is happening. This is not so much a recession. This is what the global economy looks like. The jobs are gone to India and China, and as long as we're going to have to compete against people who make under a dollar an hour, those jobs are not coming back. And the Obama administration's socialism is that the answer is, well, Americans can then just be dependent upon the federal government, and it's a short road to serfdom with this kind of government control over people's lives.
And I think that's an important point, Jerry, the fact that people don't understand this is the end result of globalism. The whole idea of globalism is to transfer our jobs, our manufacturing, our wealth, overseas to other countries. And there are 8 million jobs that are gone. They're not coming back. They're not telling us that. Oh, we're just waiting for things to get better. Ladies and gentlemen, they're not going to get better. As long as our leaders are dedicated to globalism, as long as our leaders are dedicated to equitable distribution of wealth between nations, that means we're going to raise the living standards here in America to that of the Chinese peasant. And understand, this is exactly what they're doing. You're not going to hear this, you know, from the regular controlled media, from the people who, you know, are paid such high sums of money. I like to call them the best conservatives that money could buy. But Dr. Corsi is absolutely right. This is the end result of the global economy. Well, I shouldn't say it's the end result. We're in transition. Things are, I believe, going to get a lot worse. Right now, of course, we gave $60 billion to General Motors, and so they could open new factories, and they did open new factories in China and in India. And where is the outcry? We gave, you know, Chrysler to Fiat, and they opened new plants in Mexico and in Italy. Why would we have given a major automotive producer away? We didn't get anything from Fiat at all. We just gave it to them. Well, I think people should ask that question, why? Go right ahead, Jerry.
Well, so when you get one-sixth of the population dependent on the government, you head towards serfdom, because then people can't object to government. You know, they're dependent on government. The Democrats see this as a way to build a permanent constituency. And the only benefit, the only beneficiaries of globalism are the multinational corporations, which are pursuing labor at the lowest possible price worldwide. And at the same time, we're keeping borders open. Barack Obama is determined to keep the borders open. So an underclass comes into the United States and competes for lower skilled and lower costing jobs. In the process, the American middle class is devastated. You find poverty increasing in the United States. The statistics, again, I go for poverty are, for the first time, really going up in decades. New York City just reported a 50% increase in homelessness in the last year. And you've got now 1,000 people living in the New York City subway system, which is up 11% from last year. Brooklyn's had an increase in homelessness of 100%. That's the largest of any of the boroughs. This is a phenomenon that was happening to America, of the devastation of the middle class that is inevitable with globalism. And when Obama comes in from the left and says, we're just going to have more taxes, we're going to have more government control, more social welfare programs, these are completely job-killing. So there is not going to be a return to the private economy, and the idea this is a recession. So this is a long-term, chronic, 9.5 to 10% unemployment that isn't going to go away. That's the reality. And the idea that we can provide social welfare programs that keep people on the standard of living people are accustomed to in the middle class just is not going to happen, because in the process the United States is going bankrupt trying to provide that level of social welfare.
And I think that the level of living, the standard of living, is just going to gradually contract more and more and more, and that's exactly what they want. When they have 40 million people living on food stamps today, we are in real trouble.
Well, there's no question about it. The idea that the middle class in the United States is going to shrink, the statistics are startling. When you take a look at the collapse of the middle class in terms of the, we're going to face this year, again, a million families in foreclosure. The mortgage refinancing programs that the Obama administration put into place absolutely did not work. They were total failure. And the idea that a million people are going to be thrown out of their homes and unemployment staying at 9.5 to 10%, this is for the foreseeable future, because the job market is not improving and the housing market is not improving, and there's no indication that they will anywhere near soon.
Well, because, you know, when they can pull scams like, you know, we're going to open up the production line there in Detroit, you know, hire 27,000 workers to produce a car that nobody wants, that they lose money on every car. But look at the unemployment record. I mean, look at all the new jobs we created. That is what government does. It's all a matter of perception. But when you produce jobs for a company that's losing money on every car they produce, I mean, you can't make that up in volume, that's for sure.
And I've been writing articles in my Red Alert newsletter. Here's another one I want to touch on. The only gain in employment is with federal employment. Federal government employees now earn average pay and wages of $123,000 in 2009, while workers of the private economy make $61,000, about half, in total compensation, wages and benefits. Now, Dr. Sam, that's exactly upside down. Federal government employees are dependent on taxes being paid to pay their salary. Yet the compensation in the private economy is half what the federal government is, and the compensation in the private economy is shrinking. The number of jobs are shrinking. And since Barack Obama's come into place, they can say we created 61,000 jobs this month. Well, that's fine. That's how many we created. It's not net how many jobs are around. We've net lost 3 million jobs under Barack Obama. And the only jobs that are increasing are federal jobs. Now, the expanding of the federal government to provide an expanding social welfare state, which is a socialist dream, doesn't work in an economy where the unemployment is high and the private economy is collapsing in globalism. Because there isn't the tax revenue to support this. And that's where we get back to the fact that the federal government deficit is so large, where the federal government is out there trying to raise so much treasury debt that's even looking at confiscating private retirement savings in order to finance the federal debt. It doesn't work.
And, of course, when other countries like China refuse to buy our debt, then the only other alternative for the Federal Reserve System and the Treasury is simply to create money. And as you begin to create money, why, you begin to destroy the value of the money that's there. I mean, right now there's about $3 trillion out there between the banks. And, you know, there's all this corporate holdings. But they're not spending this money. They're not lending the money out. But, of course, if something should happen and that money was suddenly released, least into the economy, especially when you have a factor, a multiplier factor of 10 to 1 for the private banks, why, you would have runaway inflation. I mean, this is the thing. The money is there, and it's just a matter of if it ever is lent out, heaven help us. And basically the only solution is to cut back on the government. New Zealand was in this situation back in the 1980s. And what they did, well, they started cutting government employees. They had 17,000 per people working for the forestry. They got down to 17 people. They had, you know, people working for the welfare department, 15,000. They ended up with 15. And eventually they were able to cut the government back and, of course, get back to a productive economy. But we're going exactly the wrong direction. We're hiring more and more government people. We pull 50,000, we pull all the combat troops out of Iraq, but they never mention they have 100,000, you know, private contractors over there in Iraq, and many of them are armed. They're not combat, they're just armed private contractors. I'm not sure what they're doing, and they're not all armed, I'm certain. They've still got 50,000 troops there. And anybody who thinks we're going to pull our troops out of the Middle East, I think has got to be incredibly, incredibly naive. But it's all a matter of perception. We're told, oh my goodness, we pulled the last combat troops, the last combat brigades out of Iraq, but we just happened to leave 50,000 troops there.
Well, Dr. Sand, one of the top investment analysts in New York looked at the Treasury purchasing, the Federal Reserve, purchasing Treasury and agency paper, largely mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Fred and Freddie Mac. Of the $2.1 trillion that was issued by the Treasury and Freddie and Fannie from June 2008 through 2009, the Federal Reserve bought 40% of the total, which means we're essentially buying our own debt, printing money in order to keep the debt machine going. Now, the Fed has essentially become the entire mortgage market. The Fed purchased nearly $500 billion of mortgage-backed securities during a period when there was only $350 billion issued, as the Fed went in and bought previously issued mortgage-backed securities. It's you know, when you look at the first 7 months of 2009, of the $1.1 trillion of net issue across Treasury markets and Freddie and Fannie, the Fed purchased almost 80% the first 7 months of 2009. These are startling statistics, and people don't realize that the Obama administration has the government buying our own debt.
And, of course, it's all with money they create out of nothing.
Out of nothing.
And eventually this means that they're progressively and intentionally destroying the value of the holdings of the American citizens. The money they have in the retirement funds, the money they have in the banks, the money they have in bonds and stocks are being progressively and intentionally destroyed by the government that's creating money to buy the debt, to pay for things that we can't afford in the first place, and you can't spend your way into prosperity. But it seems the Obama administration is intent upon that.
Well, just like the mortgage bubble burst, 2006, where we had interest rates at near zero, we had interest rates then at 1-3% in the period 2003-2004, and the mortgage market was going in. You bought Barney Frank wanting to have all the poor getting houses, and even George W. Bush got on the Home Ownership Society. Well, the subprime market, the go-go years, if you were breathing, you got a home. We're going to have the same thing happen with Treasury debt and the Freddie and Fannie. All these debt markets are going to be another bubble to burst, just like the mortgage bubble burst.
But my understanding is that Freddie and Fannie are issuing subprime loans again.
They're still doing it.
And then, in other words, they're selling, letting people buy homes who can't afford them. And when the next downturn comes, why, there's going to be another even worse collapse of the housing market. And we're simply on the verge of that, whether it's a matter of months or a year, I don't know, but it's going to happen very, very soon. And then they'll say, gee, how did it happen? Ladies and gentlemen, you can't sell things to people who can't afford them indefinitely without getting into problems. Our guest, of course, is Dr. Jerome Corsi of WorldNet Daily. We'll be back in a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Jerry, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, as I said, we talked tonight about the debt crisis, and I want people to realize how desperately the Obama administration has entered into...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. And I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about anything. any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Money from the government. Why they want, of course, a registration desk so they can be registered to vote. Why do they want a registration place to vote in places where they're giving people free money? So people will vote for the politicians who promise to give them more. Because you could always, if you could they take from Peter to pay Paul, you can always depend upon Paul's vote. But if you can actually borrow money so you can give money to both Peter and Paul, everybody is so happy. One day we're going to have to pay back the money. We're in the middle of a financial collapse of this nation. You've got to understand that. We hope you listen to our programs regularly. Certainly we've written extensively on this. We have pamphlets going into the background of how they created this whole financial collapse. Why did they create it? Because they want to destroy our economy, because they want equitable distribution of wealth between nations. That's the Earth Charter. If you get anything from Radio Liberty, just ask for a copy of the Earth Charter, and we'll send it to you. It was written by the nephew of the most powerful man in America. It was written by a man named Stephen Rockefeller. The Earth Charter, you can pull it down on the Internet. Read it. Understand. Behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces, and they want to impoverish the American people. Point 10A of the Earth Charter. Read it, understand, help us get the information out. Now, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to understand the spiritual forces at work. You need to get the DVDs on the secret mystery of America's beginning, the secret mystery of America's beginning. They're very professionally done. We certainly recommend them to you. You need to get the DVD, Constance Cumby, and her talk on the emergence, the coming of the new world leader. Chris Pinto, actually, he produced the secret mystery series, but he gave a talk for us called The Atlantis Connection. Because America is to be the new Atlantis. We are to establish an empire. Why do you think we have troops in 130 to 140 nations? Why do you think we have 720 foreign military bases throughout the world? Who are we defending ourselves against? Against nobody. We're financing communist China. We're financing communist Russia. Who do you think actually drilled the oil and gas wells in Russia to make them the largest producer of natural gas and oil in the world? You need to read my little pamphlet. It's available from Radio Liberty. It's called The Communist Capitalist Alliance. The Communist Capitalist Alliance. We actually have the material, the aid and abet documents that Larry McDonald put out just before his ill-fated flight on Korean Flight 007. If you want to know what happened to Larry McDonald, we even have a special section of 4 tapes out on Larry McDonald and information on him, Larry McDonald special. Larry McDonald tried to let the American people realize we were financing communism, creating the best enemy money could buy. If you haven't read Professor Sutton's excellent books, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and FDR and Wall Street, those three books by Professor Sutton, they're must reading for anybody who wants to understand how we've created the best enemy money could buy so we could rally the people behind the government, just like Machiavelli said in The Prince, you've got to have an enemy. You got to have an enemy. And boy, have we created some of the best enemies in the world, and including this whole Islamic terrorist movement. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we want to remind you about our all-day conference. We're going to hold it at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. It's on the 17th of October. We're bringing in excellent speakers from across America. Hope you can come. You're going to have reservations, though. We're serving lunch. So if you can make it and bring your friends and your relatives, that's October 17th right here in the North Shore of Monterey Bay. And then I will be speaking on the 18th of September in Santa Rosa. If you want to know about that, you can call our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website, radioliberty.com. Watch our videos, read our newsletters, listen to our programs 9 hours a day. Encourage others to listen, to get educated, and begin preparing for the very difficult times that lie ahead. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle. But please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection.
Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountain to the prairie to the ocean.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Craig, and former senior editor for the New American Magazine, now author, radio personality. He has his own blog. And hi, William. How are you tonight?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing well, and it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, it's our pleasure. And tell us, what you want to talk about tonight?
You probably talked about this, but I really do think that we're going to have to talk about what happened at the Discovery Channel headquarters this week, and Mr. Lee, James Lee, the alleged hostage taker, who of course was shot and killed by a SWAT team after he had taken hostage the personnel there at the Discovery Cable Network's headquarters. And he is a self-described disciple of Al Gore, whose consciousness was raised by Mr. Gore's works of environmental hysterical fiction, among them, of course, the award-winning film An Inconvenient Truth. And Mr. Lee, before he died, published a manifesto, and I wanted to read some excerpts from that. But by way of a preface to that, I think I'd like to read something that was written in 1947 by the first Director General of UNESCO, which is the United Nations Education, Social, and Cultural Organization. That's the arm of the United Nations devoted to propaganda on behalf of the worldview that the United Nations was to embody, which was to be humanist collectivism. What Mr. Huxley wrote was the following: though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care, and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake, so that much that now is unthinkable may at least become thinkable. Bear in mind, this is written in 1947. That's after World War II, and after the horrors of World War II had been made public. They were still fresh in the public mind, And I think that the regimes of Hitler and the Japanese militarists, and of course the regime of Joseph Stalin, he started out the war as a co-aggressor with Hitler in the gang rape of Poland and much of what happened by way of that incredible onslaught of mass murder called the Holocaust took place, happened because of Joseph Stalin's direct involvement. They couldn't have killed millions of people in Poland in the death camps without the help of the Soviet Union.
It's interesting, William, though, they never mentioned that. They always mentioned Adolf Hitler. The wicked Adolf Hitler invaded Poland from the West. They never mentioned that the wicked Joseph Stalin, backed by our own government, invaded Poland from the East at exactly the same time, and they divided Poland between them. Isn't it interesting that the historians seem to have forgotten that historical fact?
That's exactly right. And it was well known, at least for a while, in most American popular circles, people who were literate and politically aware and who had access to a wonderful magazine called the American Mercury, which I believe was founded by H.L. Mencken. They did a number of exposés in the late 40s talking about the fact that death camps were actually, in many instances, staffed by, presided over by people who had been trained by the KGB in the art of mass murder. The KGB, or I believe at the time was called the NKVD, the Soviet Secret Police, during the early 30s had killed between 9 and 20 million Ukrainians, so they were well-versed in the dynamics of mass murder. But all of this was sort of the overture to what Huxley was talking about. Prepare the public mind for eugenics, which of course means mass murder and population control, in order to make what is unthinkable then become thinkable. This is all said in the immediate aftermath of these revelations that were still fresh in the public mind.
But of course, what people don't understand is they've done away with the term eugenics. Now they call it population control.
Yeah.
And the population control program is underway today. They're sterilizing people throughout the world with vaccinations. Other chemicals, they know very well, the mercury reduces fertility not only in this generation, but the next generation and the next generation. They alter the genetic makeup with the mercury. That's why we're vaccinating those little black children. Go right ahead.
When Julian Huxley wrote what he did in 1947, the capacity of the public mind to absorb and project horror had already been expanded by what was learned about World War II and what had been learned about what had happened anterior to that war in Ukraine and elsewhere under the reign of the Soviet Union. But Julian Huxley wanted the public mind to be tuned in the direction of accepting the type of policies that would bring about long-term control of the population in the name of eugenics. And so UNESCO began the process, and actually it didn't really begin the process, it accelerated the process, but it began to act on the admonitions by Huxley that it undertake mass propaganda through various means in order to prepare the public mind for radical population control, and most importantly, I believe, to redefine human fecundity, the capacity for human beings to reproduce after their own kind, as a problem to be addressed by government policy. That's the chief objective here, I think, of what Huxley was propounding. Up until that time, people believed in every culture that children were a blessing. They were a burden, of course, because you have to provide for them, you have to teach them, you have to see to their physical needs, you have to love and care for them. If you become a parent, suddenly you're no longer the center of your own universe. Your family, particularly your children, have to become the center of your material universe. But it was understood that children, to invoke the psalmist, are an heritage of the Lord and that they're a blessing. And what happened since that time is a radical shift in public attitudes about the singular gift that is a family, particularly children within a family. Typically, if you have a large family, and my wife Corinne and I have six children, that's a large family. Not in historical terms, but in contemporary terms. That's a real brood. That's a horde. I mean, I like to tell people that we're almost a battalion strength by contemporary reckoning, although my wife Corinne and I each comes from a family of seven children. In my case, there are six of us who were adopted. It's really quite a remarkable situation with my parents, who are people of, in my opinion, unexampled generosity. But we each came from a family of seven children. We have six children of our own. Typically, people look at us and roll their eyes or theatrically express weariness as if to say, boy, that must be a real challenge. You've got your hands full. And there's always this undercurrent, not of admiration, but of pity, as if we somehow didn't anticipate that we would have the number of children we have, that this isn't something that reflects a choice on our part. Perhaps we're as ingenuous as the mythological Italian who supposedly thought that every time a fairy blows its nose, a child is born. You know, we understand the process by which children are born. We decided that we wanted to have these children. But there's always this undercurrent
here. Hold that thought. Hold that thought, William. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about the fact that he has a large family. He has six children, and he's very happy to have six children. He thinks that children are a blessing, and a family is really something that everybody should really covet and desire. But go right ahead, William.
Yeah. There's always this undercurrent whenever we deal with people of disapproval. It's sometimes masked, it's sometimes disguised, but there's always this sense that maybe this isn't really the best way to arrange your affairs. Having that many children isn't wise, it isn't disciplined, it isn't just, it's somehow burdening society at large. And given our straitened circumstances, we've certainly had an opportunity to make ourselves a burden on society. I've been intermittently employed since 2006, and my wife since early 2006 has had a series of really unfortunate chronic health problems that have left her a functional invalid. The reason why I'm talking about this is I'm building up to a point. I wouldn't otherwise get so deeply immersed in my own personal affairs, except by way of illustrating a point that I think resonates with what Julian Huxley was talking about. A number of months ago, after I was required to undergo hospitalization, it was a year ago, as a matter of fact, that I had to be hospitalized for a couple of weeks with a bacterial infection that almost killed me, given the fact that we haven't had health insurance because I'm an independent contractor, and we have these huge medical bills. I had to go and seek counseling here from the county government in Paya County, Idaho, where we live. Small town, 8,000 people, more or less. The county's only about 10,000 people in total. And my purpose in doing this is I was required to do this by the hospital in search of some way of paying off some element of the bills that I owe. And I was talking with the local counselor here, and she was flatly and unambiguously disapproving of the number of children that we have. She looked at me, she sighed with disgust, she rolled her eyes. Bear in mind as well that this is somebody I had known as a child. I had actually grown up in the same small town in Oregon with this woman, hadn't seen her in a number of decades. She became a bureaucrat, albeit a county bureaucrat in a small town, and I became a freedom-minded journalist and activist. And she made the point that we really shouldn't have this many children, and I looked at her and rather coldly said, "How many children should we have fewer than the ones that we have, and how do I go about deciding which ones we're going to discard?" As if that were any of her business. That's not a conversation that would have taken place 60 years ago or 70 years ago. There, of course, even in the early decades of the 20th century, there was a shift in attitudes, largely, of course, brought about by that execrable organization Planned Parenthood, which even in the 1920s was talking about weeding the human garden, trying to get rid of the overgrowth of undesirables and so forth. There's that scene from that wonderful movie Cheaper by the Dozen, the original version, not the remakes with Steve Martin, the one starring Clifton Webb, which dealt with the true story of a man who had a dozen children. He was an efficiency expert. He taught businesses in the 1920s how to make optimal use of their time. The reason he's able to do this is because he and his wife had 12 children, and they had to organize their time very strictly. But there's the scene, and bear in mind, this movie is based on a memoir, it's a true story, in which the wife, a lovely and well-spoken woman, was approached by a representative of the local population control. That's not what it was called at the time. It was called, I believe, the local, they actually used the term eugenics, local eugenics organization. They wanted to recruit her as a speaker to represent the cause of population control, and then what the woman did by way of answering her was invite little groups of her children to congregate in the living room and let their presence attest tacitly to her perspective on the question of population control. This was in the 1920s. So the groundwork was being laid back then by these foundation-funded groups that were openly and unblushingly referring to the idea of government control of human reproduction and limitations on family size, and the use of government coercive methods to intervene to sterilize and otherwise incapacitate people who are considered to be undesirables. There are legal decisions, Supreme Court decisions from the 1920s that talk in unblushing and unflinching terms about the supposed desirability of restricting the reproductive capacity of people who are considered undesirables. There's that famous line, three generations of imbeciles is enough. Now, that was happening in this country in the 1920s when a very similar movement was gestating, if you'll forgive me for using that verb, in Germany, that eventually reached term and became the National Socialist regime in Germany. But that, of course, is the mindset that coalesced in UNESCO that Julian Huxley was talking about back in 1947. This was a time when Auschwitz was in the rear view. People understood what had been going on in Germany. They understood that this was done in the name of eugenics. As a matter of fact, a lot of the war propaganda here in the United States under a government that was being spectacularly hypocritical because it had underwritten a lot of these things in Germany and in the Soviet Union, and it had been involved in promoting the same policies in the 1920s and 1930s here in the United States, albeit on a more limited basis. But a lot of the war propaganda of the 1940s focused on the horrible things that were being done by the German government. And yet, popular entertainment, popular culture, a lot of the literature in academia started to reflect this idea that government has to limit what people can do in terms of the number of children they have. And this was carrying out, I believe, the mandate described by Julian Huxley in UNESCO in 1947. Once again, what he talked about was the need to examine the eugenic problem with the greatest care and to make the public mind informed of the issues at stake so that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. Now, flash forward a little bit to the 1970s, the early 1970s, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a Rutgers law professor, and she was writing with respect to the Roe versus Wade decision, which was packaged for public consumption as something that represented a breakthrough for what was called reproductive freedom. It has nothing to do with reproduction. Abortion, of course, is the negation of reproduction. We're not talking about the termination of a pregnancy, which is another preferred euphemism, pregnancy being a self-terminating condition. It ends when a healthy child is born, or when, for whatever reason, there is a fatal mishap that results in the child not coming to term. Pregnancy is a condition that is self-terminating. It's not a perpetual incapacity with respect to the woman's time horizon and life choices. But the whole point of Roe versus Wade was to put the government in the position of defining who is a person for the purposes of law, and even more specifically for the purpose of protecting the individual rights of a human being at the most elemental level, that it has to do with the fundamental right to life, to be protected from lethal aggression against that individual. And Roe versus Wade, very cunningly, the decision does not define when life begins for the purpose of protection of the individual under law, and by refusing to define it in the most obvious terms, which is that when the human individual is created, the human individual acquires the right, the presumptive and preemptive right to protection against lethal violence. That, of course, wouldn't do. And so they didn't define when life begins. All that they did was state in a negative fashion, Harry Blackmun in this decision, that it doesn't occur any time before birth. But he didn't define the time after birth, after the delivery of a living child, at which point the child would acquire the right to life. Which is why, of course, we now have it's not a commonplace procedure, but it doesn't have to be commonplace in order to be an utter atrocity. That form of infanticide called partial birth abortion, which is where a living child who is perfectly viable, and you need to use the personal pronoun who here. We're not describing a what or an it. We're describing a he or a she. But a living, perfectly viable child is killed during the process of delivery. But under the logic of Roe versus Wade, full-term infanticide, that is to say, physically separated, perfectly viable, readily identifiable human infants, do not have the presumptive right to life either. And a lot of the literature that was being disseminated before Roe versus Wade and even more openly after Roe versus Wade, this was shut down, I think, around the late 1970s. They're no longer speaking quite so overtly about this. There was a lot of legal speculation about the idea that neonates, which would be children as old as my youngest, Justice, who is about a year and a half old, they're not fully developed in terms of the cognitive functions that would demonstrate individualism, according to this legal literature. And because that's the case, they can't really be considered viable. They can't survive without the constant supervisory care of the mother and the father. So they're not really fully realized individuals. Thus, they're not fully blessed with the right to life. in the event that you're dealing with a child who is handicapped or otherwise has a stunted quality of life, that they should be considered individuals subject to summary execution if that is to be considered in the best interest of that child and the child's mother, the child's parents, or in the best interest of the community. There's a lot of literature to that effect that was propounded in the 1970s. Well, that was the environment in which Ruth Bader Ginsburg was evaluating the Roe versus Wade decision, and she pointed out that the Roe versus Wade decision, from her perspective, was the product of, and I quote now from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations we don't want too many of. Once again, concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations we don't want too many of. Now, what populations would those be? Now, that's pure, unfiltered, unalloyed 1920s or 1930s vintage eugenics. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, is now sitting on the Supreme Court. Her expectation was that the so-called right to abortion created in the Roe decision was going to be then set up for Medicaid funding for abortions, which some people felt would risk coercing women into having abortions when they didn't really want them. That's really interesting. She doesn't talk about what part of the human population, quote-unquote, we should cull, or how the creation of an abortion right would necessarily be a prelude to compelled abortion, but that's the logic of the decision. She intuited that correctly. What's interesting to me is that she felt confident in expressing those thoughts out loud.
In other words, basically what they really wanted to do was target the blacks, because that was exactly what Margaret Sanger wanted. That's what we're doing today as far as Africa. And the massive vaccination program with mercury-laden vaccines that will destroy the fertility of this generation and the next generation and the generation after that, because you altered the genes. It's called epigenetics. You should understand what's going on, and then perhaps you'll want to join us in this effort to get the truth out. William, go right ahead.
Now, flash forward from 19...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey Water Filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
Of population control by this elite, and there is an elite who are planning our future. You're not allowed to know that. You're not supposed to believe that. You're supposed to believe this is all democratic, but of course it really isn't. The ruling elite has decided there are too many people in the world, and they intend to, by one means or another, and probably by a number of means, to dramatically decrease the population of the world. Now, William, apparently, was in Egypt at one of these population control meetings. When was that meeting, William?
That was in August and September of 1994.
All right, you go ahead and tell the story.
One of the proposals that was discussed was the idea of using the leverage that the United Nations had obtained in Haiti, following the invasion of Haiti under UN Security Council mandates by the United States, to compel the inhabitants of that island, many of whom are Roman Catholic, to accept population control, to accept sterilization, to accept chemical contraceptives, and to accept abortion. As a matter of fact, there was a memorandum that was being circulated by the United Nations that was reproduced, somehow ended up in the possession of Alexander Coburn, who publishes a wonderful newsletter called Counterpunch. And Mr. Coburn describes himself as a socialist, but he's a socialist of a rather interesting type. He believes in voluntary socialism. I don't know anybody would volunteer for it. But here's a person who is pretty consistently opposed to the United Nations and all of its works and pomps. He's somebody who supports property rights, at least in terms of preventing coercive government negation of property rights. He supports the right to keep and bear arms, which is almost unheard of among self-described left-wing socialists. He just happens to believe that if you want to live in a commune somewhere and share your wealth as a matter of egalitarian redistribution on a voluntary basis, the way that some Israeli kibbutzim, for instance, organize themselves, that's perfectly fine. Just doesn't want the government to be involved in this. But he came into the possession of a memorandum that was being circulated by the United Nations Population Fund, which had targets and quotas for acceptors of population control initiatives in Haiti. So they were already doing this at the time that this was being openly discussed in August, September of 1994 in Cairo. The other thing that I heard, actually I read in the Earth Times, which was the official publication put out during that conference, was that a fellow by the name of Patrick Mazimuka, who was the Minister for Youth and I believe Youth Culture and Sporting Activities in Rwanda. This was after the 100-day genocide in Rwanda, where something on the order of 1.8 million people were killed. Between 600,000 and 1.8 million people were killed in the 100-day orgy of slaughter. Most of them were hacked to death by machetes, but the people wielding the machetes had at their backs people with automatic weapons, and the targeted population had been disarmed by the United Nations peacekeepers. But they lost a fifth or a quarter of their population. I mean, we're talking about a genocide of Cambodian magnitude and probably unprecedented killing efficiency. But Patrick Mazimuka gave a speech, and he was, from the account I read, rather stunned to recognize this. Under the demographic targets, that's a euphemism, of course, for population control quotas, that the United Nations was setting in Cairo, Rwanda's population was still too big. After losing between, a fifth and a quarter of their population through genocide, they still had too many people. Just to give you an idea of the severity here of what we're talking about, if you can't meet that quota through genocide, how on earth are you going to meet that quota? And by what presumed right does the United Nations dictate such matters to anybody, whether you're talking about national governments or individuals? Well, this all reflects what Julian Huxley was talking about in 1947. And by way of seeing how these toxic ideas were leached, if you will, into the bloodstream of public conversation, we have to roll back the clock a little bit to the year 1967, which really was, if you'll forgive me for using the expression, a seminal year. That was the year that the population bomb was published. That was the year that Kingsley Davis, who was a sociologist, a demographer, and a population control activist and guru, published an essay in Science magazine in which he said the following: the social structure and economy must be changed before a deliberate reduction in the birth rate can be achieved in the West. And he urged governments to subsidize voluntary abortion and then move in the direction of compulsory abortion and other means of compulsory birth control in order to bring about what Huxley was talking about. That was in 1967. 6 years later, we have Roe versus Wade, and people are talking about slaughtering newborns to achieve those ends as well.
All right, well, hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. I would simply point out that if you read the literature put out by the population control people, they said we've got to put something in the water to decrease fertility. Mm-hmm. Of course,
exactly.
That's what fluoride is. Fluoride decreases fertility. They put things into vaccines. That's the mercury. They don't need to put it in there, but it alters fertility. They do the same thing with the aspartame they put in our drugs, the new genetically modified foods. They know what they're doing. They just don't want you to know what they're doing. Ahead, William.
I mentioned this Science magazine essay by Kingsley Davis in 1967. A few years later, actually 2 years later, Frederick Jaffe, who was the vice president of Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood International, which of course was founded by the, or not founded, but funded heavily by the Rockefellers and people of that kidney, published a memorandum that was based on Kingsley Davis's recommendations. And it was published, actually, in October 1970. It was circulated privately in 1969, published in October 1970 in Family Planning Perspectives, which is an official publication of Planned Parenthood. And it organized the various social policies for bringing about radical population control under four headings: social constraints, economic deterrence and incentives, social controls, and housing policies. And Paul Ehrlich had made this suggestion before Jaffe did. But he suggested in the October 1970 issue of Family Planning Perspectives the placement of fertility control agents in the water supply. And this recommendation, oddly enough, was filed under social constraints. Social controls included such measures as compulsory abortion of all out-of-wedlock pregnancies, compulsory sterilization of all who have two children except for a few who would be allowed three. That's cognate with the policy in China where you're permitted one child under certain circumstances. You're permitted to have two, depending upon what the local commissariat does in implementing the national population policy. And the issuance of stock certificate-type permits for children. Now, nearly every radical population control template I've read is built around the idea of a government-issued permit or a license to have children. That's something that enjoyed a brief vogue back in 1994, just shortly before I went to Cairo. And I and a few other people, Don Fetter among them, publicized Jack Westman's book, Licensing Parents, which was being promoted as a way of preventing child abuse. But, of course, that's a back door into the idea of government control of the means of reproduction, if you will, through licensure. When I was doing my radio program a few weeks ago, there was a fellow from Arizona called in and said, why isn't this a good idea? And, of course...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney William was talking about the idea that, certainly as they have in China, that we would want to introduce here in America this idea you'd have to have a license to have a child. It would be very rare that you get a license for two children. But before we go on and develop this idea, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, how they can listen to your radio program, and how they can find about your PayPal button and help support you, because I think that William is doing certainly a great job, and I think that his commentary has helped a lot of people to see clearly what's going on today. But how can people get to your blog site? How can people get to your radio program?
Thanks so much, Dr. Stan. I sure appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate, ProLibertate. Perhaps the easiest way to find it is just to type Pro Libertate in my last name, Grigg, into a search engine, Google or whichever search engine you happen to find most suitable to your needs, and the first result should be my blog. It's also found at the web address freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I try to update it between 2 and 4 times a week, depending upon my circumstances. And my radio show is also called Pro Libertate. It's a Latin phrase I'm quite fond of. It means for freedom. As it happens, that's the motto found on the family crest of the Wallace family, as in William Wallace, the legendary Scottish freedom fighter after whom I named our oldest son, William Wallace Grigg. Pro Libertate, the radio program, is broadcast every Saturday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time on the Liberty News Radio Network. LibertyNewsRadio.com is the homepage for Liberty News Radio, LibertyNewsRadio.com. If you go to that website, there's a list of affiliates. I believe there are probably 40 or 50 or 60. I can't remember how many, but there are several dozen national affiliates whereby people can listen to the program by way of terrestrial radio. There's also the live streaming function available through the website for people who want to listen to the simulcast online. The programs are archived. They're available by way of podcast at libertynewsradio.com. Dr. Stan, you'd also mentioned that in my blog I do have a PayPal button for those who have the means and the interest in contributing to me to keep my one-man media empire, such as it is, going. And I want to take this opportunity to thank those in your audience who over the last couple of weeks have given very generously to me and my family. This is how I'm trying to provide for my family. This is a large family. You know, the typical allotment of challenges that a family of our sort would have. And over the last couple of weeks, there have been a number of people who have been very generous, just amazingly generous in donating to me and to my family. On behalf of Corinne and our kids, I really want to express my deep and sincere gratitude. It's very gratifying, and it's a little bit humbling to know that people have seen fit to provide so generously to us. And, of course, I recognize that anytime somebody does something as generous as this, it's a manifestation of God working through them, and I've on more than a few occasions recently looked skyward or got on my knees and offered thanks that the Lord is providing to us in this means. But I recognize that means that there are people who are attuned to Him, and that this has been a way that they have seen fit to discharge their responsibilities to our Creator and helping us in our time of need. We've had some needs recently that people have been very generous in helping to provide. I really appreciate that, and I'm grateful to you as well, Dr. Stan, for taking the time to offer me an opportunity to plug what I'm doing.
Well, of course, we really appreciate what you do, William. Well, you were talking about this idea that, certainly wouldn't it be more efficient if people just had to get a license? That you'd been discussing this on your radio program. Somebody called in and said, what's wrong with requiring a license? After all, we don't want too many children. What was the basic tone of his call, and what was your response?
Well, he was sincere, and he was asking an honest question. That's the thing that I find remarkable, is that you're dealing with somebody who's not obviously depraved or malicious. He's somebody who had been exposed to these ideas, and he wanted to know what was wrong with it. Of course, the fundamental question is, to use another Latin phrase, quo warranto, by what authority does the government presume to tell me how many children I can have? You see, that's not something that they're responsible for. In the grand scheme of things, they don't have the authority to regulate that question. If the government issues a license, what it's saying is that it is granting a privilege, and that by doing so in this case, they're usurping the role of the creator. They're saying that this is a function which we will regulate because basically we are, for all intents and purposes, God. That's a Hegelian concept. The George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the 19th century exponent of the dialectic and the 19th century avatar, if you will, or actually not the avatar, but really the 19th century founder of modern statism, said that the state is God walking on the earth, that basically government is, for all intents and purposes, a deity. And if you have the government in the position of granting a license over a function that actually the creator defines, then you're embracing what has to be considered a fundamentally pagan, idolatrous view of government. And how do you go about enforcing this in a way that doesn't involve wholesale, consummate violations of every right that a human being is entitled to, that a human being was endowed with by his creator? That's something that not many people really think about, but if you usurp that function, many people who call themselves quote-unquote pro-choice regarding abortion, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg's case illustrates, they make that very quick conceptual jump from defending the supposed right to kill a developing child in the womb as a token of freedom of choice. They make an immediate conceptual leap from that position to embracing the idea that it's a good idea to be doing this because otherwise we'd have too many people. And what they mean by that is too many other people. Way back in the late 19th, early 20th century, G.K. Chesterton, wonderful writer, wonderfully insightful person, singular and unparalleled prose stylist, who had had some experience with the Fabian socialists in Britain who were promoting a lot of these noxious ideas back then, wrote an essay in which he said that people who fret about surplus, you know, about excess human population, people who worried about overpopulation, never consider themselves to be among the surplus. And that, of course, is one of the deeply and intractably misanthropic things about this entire discussion. The people who promote population control consider themselves to be indispensable and the rest of us to be insufferable. But this is something that's become a nostrum which has been embraced by people who are not notably evil or nasty, but who seem to think nonetheless that somehow the government's got the right, by virtue, I guess, of necessity, to define that question for the rest of us. And this is something which has been done with the eager support and the generous, albeit pilfered largesse, of the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, which has given at least a half a dozen awards to China, which operates, of course, an overtly totalitarian one-child population policy that includes not only compulsory abortion, but also infanticide. And infanticide is not merely a side effect of a culture in which if you're allowed one child, if you have the so-called misfortune of having a female child in a lot of the rural areas of China, by way of preserving their quota, parents are driven to kill the girl child. And you have this huge imbalance now between the sexes in China. You've got a whole generation, literally tens or hundreds of millions of marriageable age Chinese men who are dealing with a government-inflicted shortfall of marriageable women of the same age. Now, that's going to lead to some really interesting problems in China over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. The next generation is going to be dealing with that issue as a result of what's been going on in this UN-approved and UN-underwritten program in communist China. But the same people who promoted that, including, of course, the program of parental licensure, the idea that government is in the position to define how many children you can have by virtue of granting permission through a license, the same people promoting that evil idea, promoting it here, they're just being a little bit more subtle about it. John Holdren, I mentioned him a few minutes ago, is the science czar in the Obama administration. He's the guy who has the ear of the president with respect to the political applications of science. He's somebody who supports and has not disavowed his support for radical eugenics and coercive population control. Now, this is all stuff that he was writing in 1977 when you could be somewhat candid about your objectives. He's been a little bit stealthier, a little more circumspect in the intervening decades. really, if you want to understand the flavor of the times, go back and read a 1970 Science magazine article. You should be able to find it in any reasonably well-appointed library, by Garrett Hardin, who was a professor, I believe, of economics in Colorado. I can't remember which university in Colorado. But he wrote an essay entitled Parenthood, Writer Privilege. As a matter of fact, find it online. Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Hardin, H-A-R-D-I-N. The article from Science Magazine is entitled Parenthood, colon, Right or Privilege. How can we reduce population, he wrote. Persuasion must be tried first. Mild coercion may soon be accepted, for example, tax rewards for reproductive non-proliferation. But in the long run, a purely voluntary system selects for its own failure. Non-cooperators outbreed cooperators. So what restraints shall we employ? A policeman under every bed? Jail sentences? Compulsory abortion? Infanticide? Memories of Nazi Germany rise and obscure our vision, wrote Hardin. Oh, those dreadful Nazis, if only they hadn't given totalitarian eugenics a bad name, in other words. That's more or less a summary of his perspective. Now, all that was being talked about, written about in the 1970s, and then because of, I believe, the emergence of the Right to Life movement and the efforts by Right to Life activists to publicize what these people were saying and what they were publishing when they thought nobody was paying attention, there was sort of a semi-translucent veil slapped down to where it became more and more difficult to get these people on record talking about what they were really doing. But these things were being implemented, once again, in Asia, in Africa. Africa in particular, as you point out, Dr. Stan, has borne the brunt of these malign designs.
But, you know, even here in the United States, people have never understood the marriage tax. I mean, why do married people have to, you know, pay more taxes than every single, you know? In fact, you're better off not to get married and have the man and woman living together, but not to get married. Because, of course, if you are married and file a joint tax return, it's going to cost you more money. Why would you do that? Why, very simply, because they don't want people to get married, and they're going to punish them economically. But the average American can't understand, and the members of Congress say, oh, we just don't know how to get rid of this tax. It would be so expensive. If we got rid of the tax, we'd like to get rid of the tax. We certainly wouldn't want anybody to think we're punishing people for getting married, but we're so incompetent, we don't know what to do. And the truth of the matter is, they want to punish them for getting married because people get married and have children, and they don't want children until people understand that this is all very diabolically designed. And I do believe, whatever, that there is an element of evil behind this. I do not believe some of the people certainly are gullible. Some of the people have never thought this thing through, but some of the people know exactly what they're doing.
Oh,
and
no doubt about
evil,
that.
Evil. They are evil people.
No doubt about that. I think the gentleman who called our radio show a number of weeks or months ago is a good example of the sort of person who's ingenuous rather than insane or deranged or diabolical. I think he's somebody who has been influenced by people he's never met and will never meet, who have bewitched his intellect by propounding ideas that are superficially plausible but deeply incorrigibly evil. I think that's a reflection of the fact that people can be influenced by that element you just described, Dr. Stan, people who have chosen and are avidly pursuing evil. And on that subject, I have to bring up David Katz. He's a medical doctor. He's the director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center, which deals with preventive medicine, which means changes in lifestyles to prevent chronic diseases, such as heart disease, type 2 diabetes, all these things that happen as a result of bad lifestyles. September 1st of this year, he published an essay entitled Overpopulation, 9 Billion Things to Talk About. He talks about all these things that are happening in the world that supposedly reflect man-made or what they call anthropogenic global warming or climate change, famines, droughts, flooding, all these things are supposedly happening because there are too many of us. The root cause that connects these dots, he writes, and many others, is global population growth. There are too many of us. Then he says, I was quite stunned when I spoke last year at the Imagine Solutions Conference in Naples, Florida, that my fellow speakers addressing the trials and tribulations of the world spoke about a rapid descent towards a global population of 9 billion or more as a fait accompli. Even though it was the driving force behind the problem they went on to discuss, depleting of the oceans, climate change, deforestation, etc., it was not discussed as a problem in its own right. I had a similar impression when I last participated in the Aspen Ideas Festival. Here's a guy who's really at sort of the apex here of the government and foundation-funded and foundation-allied intelligentsia. And he talks about all these things that supposedly are a reflection of too many people being present. And he says, by way of concluding the September 1st article, we have met the enemy, and in our ever-growing voracious multitudes, it is us. We have 9 billion, or is it 12, things to start thinking about as soon as possible. He goes on to point out that he has 5 children, and that it's sort of a wimp factor type of a subject to discuss, that meaning population. But former drug users often make the best addiction counselors, and some of the top obesity experts struggle with their own weight. I suppose I can come clean about population pressures, despite having done such a poor job of keeping my own genes to myself. And that really horrible sentence is pregnant, if you'll excuse the expression once again, with this awful question. Okay, you have 5 children. Which of them would you dispense with in the interest of preserving our holy goddess mother Gaia? You know, which of these children, if any, are you willing to sacrifice on Gaia's altar? Because if you're serious about what you're saying, that's implicit in what you just said. Now, that was published on September 1st. September 2nd is when this idiot James Lee invaded the Discovery Channel headquarters after publishing a manifesto that is replete with exactly the same ideas that were being expressed by this reputable, credentialed Ivy League medical doctor and science advisor, where he was saying, among other things, all programs in Discovery Health and the Learning Channel must stop encouraging the birth of any more parasitic human infants and the false heroics behind those actions. In those programs' places, programs encouraging human sterilization and infertility must be pushed. All former pro-birth programs must now push in the direction of stopping human birth, not encouraging it. Then he goes on to say, all human procreation and farming must cease. The planet does not need humans. Children represent future catastrophic pollution, whereas their parents are current pollution. No more babies. Population growth is the real crisis. This means stopping the human race from breeding any more disgusting human babies. You're the media. You can reach people. It's your responsibility because you reach so many minds. He was promoting exactly the same things that this Dr. David Katz had been promoting the day before in his nationally syndicated column. The difference is that James Lee was an environmentalist in a hurry, and he was really laying bare the criminal coercion, the deranged, demonic, hateful, murderous coercion that is implicit in all of this eugenicist and antinatalist activism.
And unfortunately, ideas have consequences, and this is the consequence of that. Now, it doesn't mean everybody who is advocating these things they do bear a sense of responsibility for it. Because the end result of this, of course, is going to be the mass destruction of a great deal of the world's population. One only has to read the writings of people like Jacques Cousteau, who talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. 350,000 people a day. Why doesn't anybody ever tell us about Jacques Cousteau? Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Once again, it's always a pleasure and a privilege to be with you. You mentioned Jacques.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-Dry Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.